The Guardian.
Politics and politicians grapple with racism in the UK. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
I truly believe that we are a much, much less racist society than we were. In many ways, we're far happier and better. But we must also frankly acknowledge that there is so much more to do.
At Monday's lobby, the briefing for political journalists, a Downing Street spokesperson said the Prime Minister did not think the UK was a racist country. Later that evening, Boris Johnson tried to walk back that assertion, saying in an article for The Voice that the UK was instead a much, much less racist country than it once was. He went on to say he would not support those who flout the rules on social distancing in order to protest, adding that those caught vandalising public property would meet the full force of the law. The tone has been different, but his message has been echoed by many politicians in Westminster. The message that says to those protesters who tore down a statue of the slaver Edward Colston in Bristol, "We support your ends, but not your means." Or put another way, "We support your cause, but not your actions." And yet many protesters would say that actions speak louder than words, and it's their action which has had such an immediate impact. So why does UK politics struggle to tackle racism? Will the events of the last 2 weeks force politicians on both sides to make a change? We'll discuss that with our panel. Also,
we will be working to bring all children back to school in September.
Parents and children around England were left disappointed this week as the government was forced to admit that plans to reopen schools would have to be postponed until September at the earliest. But not to worry, Legoland, Thorpe Park and Chessington World of Adventures will be reopening on July the 4th. What's more, we're set to see non-essential shops reopen from next week, and there's been talk of pubs with outdoor space reopening at the start of July. So why does the government deem it more dangerous to send kids back to school than to reopen some sectors of the economy? Plus, The Guardian's diplomatic editor Patrick Wintour updates us on what's happening in Hong Kong. He explains why the government's sudden tough stance on China, opposing its plan to impose new security laws on Hong Kong, might end up backfiring on the UK in the long run. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, this week saw tensions rise in Westminster, from the Prime Minister having to address the fraught issue of racism in the UK, to the government having to admit it won't be able to keep its promise to get all pupils back to school before September, at the very earliest. To discuss all that, I'm joined now by The Guardian's political editor, Heather Stewart. Heather, great to have you back on. Like me, you have been navigating that tricky balancing act of working from home alongside raising and schooling your children. Was there some disappointment in the Stewart household when the government announced they weren't going to be able to get all pupils back to school before September?
To be honest, reality had dawned quite a bit earlier than that, because I'm one of those people. I have one child in one of those years that can go back, and the other child who can't go back. And it had been pretty clear from quite early on that the school doesn't have extra classrooms or extra teachers enough to welcome back every other year. So really, this was the government catching up with sort of reality that most parents had noticed some time ago, I think.
And when people will hear this podcast, we're putting up just before today's daily coronavirus briefing, where the Prime Minister is expected to announce some lockdown lifting measures, including the reopening of zoos from next Monday. I don't know about your children, whether they like to see caged animals or not, but children might enjoy going to see elephants and that kind of thing. But it does seem unfair and also quite weird, isn't it, that children will be able to return to look at lions and tigers or go to Thorpe Park before they can go back to school.
It's very weird, isn't it? And I think it just underlines the fact that this aspiration or this sort of intention of getting everyone a month's schooling, every child a month's schooling before the summer holidays, which it just feels like the practicalities of that were not thought through. You know, that the Department for Education guidance is that kids have to be in groups of 15 or less And there just aren't enough classrooms or enough teachers in most ordinary primary schools to make that happen. Why that didn't dawn on anyone at an earlier stage. And Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions today raised the comparison with the Nightingale hospitals, you know, these extraordinary COVID-19 hospitals that were sort of built within weeks in the health service. It would have taken something of that sort of intensity, I think, to prepare schools to do this impossible thing.
It's been played out as a kind of ideological question about when schools should, you know, is it a priority to get children back or not? And yet, as you say, wholly a practical question. When Keir Starmer did raise it, how did Boris Johnson respond?
So the Conservatives have been very keen to sort of trap Labour on this because, as you say, at the earlier stages, they saw it as a kind of ideological issue. You know, the teaching unions were very cautious about this and did raise concerns. And there was a sort of effort, I think, from the government to paint this as, oh, you know, these terrible militant unions, they're stopping your children going back to school. They need to do their duty. But actually, you know, as you say, it's the sheer practicality of it. And the Prime Minister tried to sort of return to that today and suggested that Labour had been sceptical about schools reopening in the first place, which they were a bit. They supported the teaching unions. They said, let's try and have track and trace in place. Let's make sure this is safe. He was trying to suggest that Starmer had sort of flip-flopped. You know, he made a sort of joke about lawyers, you know, one brief one day, another brief the next, and tried to say that Starmer had not been consistent.
Has Johnson got a point on that, on the inconsistency that Labour were complaining it was too soon and now complaining it's too late?
A little bit, I think. It's certainly there was a point where Labour seemed to be more concerned about the safety issues, which I think a lot of parents were, and I think certainly teaching unions were. But in more recent weeks, and certainly from Starmer himself, rather than Rebecca Long-Bailey, who's the Shadow Education Secretary, of course, Starmer himself has been saying for quite some time, we need kids to be back as soon as it's safe.
One of the things that obviously would have helped up this whole process, and indeed generally emerging from lockdown, would be a fully functioning test and trace system. The government rhetoric has been that we're going to have not just a system, but a world-beating system. And yet the Independent Sage Group, that's that unofficial group of expert scientists and epidemiologists and others, they said earlier this week that the UK system is not only not world-beating, it's actually not even fit for purpose. So who should we believe, Heather?
Well, even those running the system admit that it's far from perfect, I think. It's been a bit of a journey, this, hasn't it? Because at the early stages when it was first announced, Matt Hancock was suggesting this glorious app that NHS have developed that's being trialled on the Isle of Wight. That was going to be an absolutely critical sort of key part of this system. It turned out the app was rather glitchy and difficult to get started. Actually, we were going to rely much more on human contact tracers, people who ring you up and sort of talk to you and tell you to stay at home. And they've also very belatedly involved local public health authorities who had been sort of kept out of the planning all along. And now suddenly, because we're talking about local lockdowns now, local government is being involved to some extent, although they still say they don't have the data, they don't have the powers really to do what they're being asked to do. So I think it's absolutely true that it's a long way from perfect.
I mean, far from perfect could almost be the slogan for this government's handling of the crisis, and an understatement it would be as well. Now, we've been talking about the track and trace system, and if that was properly up and running, it might be required and pressed into action for many of those who attended protests across the country over the past week. But it has been striking the kind of conflict that many in Westminster seem to be feeling, where on the one hand, they want to stand with protesters, and on the other, they do worry about appearing to contradict everything they've been saying until now about there being a public health crisis and the necessity to stay home and, at the very least, keep your distance.
It's a very difficult one. And of course, the Conservatives, I think, particularly in some of those red wall seats. So if you think about, you know, a lot of those seats that the Tories took for the first time in December, I think there'd be a feeling that their constituents might be more concerned about the sort of law and order aspects of it and certainly might not share the concerns of those protesters. So rightly or wrongly, those MPs, you know, there were a group of them who came and tried to scrub the Winston Churchill statue as a sort of symbolic thing they're very keen to say, look at Labour. They support all these sort of crazy causes. We support law and order. But actually, when you saw the Labour front bench, Keir Starmer and also the Shadow Home Secretary, Nick Thomas Simmons, they were very keen to say, we support the police. You know, Nick Thomas Simmons said, I'd like to hear from the Home Secretary whether those injured police are OK, you know, but at the same time, the government needs to do much more on racism and we understand the protest. But it's a hard line to walk, I think.
On the pandemic itself, which of course remains still the backdrop to the politics of this year and perhaps many years to come, the focus among many people now is about the fear of a second wave hitting this country. You do sense that there's a sort of positioning already going on about who will bear the blame for that. But if that second wave does come, is it your sense that there'll be a sort of breach, a break in trust between public and government? As if public have been prepared to give the benefit of the doubt to government so far, but if there's a second wave, somehow something will change?
Yeah, I think the government's problem is that it's already draining away that public support, or certainly that's what the polls tell you and that's what the focus groups seem to tell you, that absolutely there was a wave of public support for Boris Johnson in the early days of the crisis and for the government's approach. And actually, Labour were quite quiescent, weren't they, in those early days of Keir Starmer's leadership, that there was a feeling that this is a national effort, let's all get together. And there we all were applauding the NHS and so on. And it just feels, as the weeks have gone by since and as the death toll is so high and as there are these sort of weird irrationalities about the way the lockdown has been handled, I think it's already draining away. But the government is certainly very much hoping never to have another national lockdown, I think.
Heather, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Now, while the government has been grappling with decisions at home, it's found its voice, perhaps unexpectedly, on the question of China and its decision to roll out new security laws in Hong Kong, laws that would see Hong Kong stripped of some of its traditional freedoms. Towards the end of May, commentators were voicing their frustration at the British government's initially muted response to what many were calling the end of the one country, two systems principle in Hong Kong. But last week, in a very significant move, the Prime Minister announced he was ready to offer a right to live and work in the UK to any of the nearly 3 million Hong Kong citizens eligible for a British national overseas passport. In this report, The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Wintour, explains why the UK government is suddenly standing up to China and why they may come to regret that decision.
It's been rumoured for a while that China was going to introduce new security laws. They had actually attempted to do so in 2003 and pulled back due to the scale of the protests. But when the Chinese People's Congress were going to meet, which was last month, it became clear that this issue of a new draconian security laws was going to be passed at the Congress. And the most important aspect of it was that none of these laws were going to go through Hong Kong's own legislature, but they were going to be implemented directly by the Chinese. I think the scale of what was being proposed and the context in which it was happening was the two issues. The first, about the actual content, the concern was that it was going to make it possible to prosecute separatists, what they described as subversives and terrorists, and any acts or activities related to that could be prosecuted. And finally, there was going to be an element whereby the Chinese security forces were going to be able to operate freely within Hong Kong. So that's the content. As to the context, there's been a rising concern in America and Europe about the broad political direction of China. The assumption had been that as the country became more prosperous, China would become more westernized, and that's not been proven to be the case.
Even at this stage, I sincerely hope China will reconsider its approach. But if not, the UK will not just look the other way when it comes to the people of Hong Kong.
There was a lot of criticism of the UK government because as the former colonial power, there was a sense there was a greater responsibility and that they should be at the forefront of the criticism. And in fact, the UK was pretty tepid in its response, using words like concern And then it started to heat up because I think there's been a mood on the conservative benches that the UK really needed to rethink its whole policy towards China. And Hong Kong became the kind of symbol of this rethink or reset. Back in May, I wrote a piece saying that I thought the UK had too much at stake in China to really put up a major resistance about what was happening in Hong Kong. And that's based on the fact that the UK is the number one country for foreign direct investment from China. And there is obviously also within Hong Kong itself a big UK trading relationship. And the reality was that if there wasn't a big alliance against what China was doing, the UK on its own criticizing specifically Hong Kong as opposed to China's wider politics, if it was acting on its own, it would be a pretty lonely, futile gesture. There's also a kind of official Foreign Office view, which is that there is no world problem that can be solved from COVID-19 to climate change, which does not involve the active cooperation of China. So there was a sense in the Foreign Office that you had to tread cautiously.
If China follows through with its proposed legislation, we will put in place new arrangements to allow BNOs to come to the UK without the current six-month limit, enabling them to live and apply to study and work for extendable periods of 12 months, thereby also providing a pathway to citizenship.
Well, as we stand now, there's a specific thing that the Cabinet seems to have agreed, which is about giving greater visa rights and access to UK citizenship to quite a now large group of Hong Kong citizens. And what may seem like a fantastically grand gesture, which could see as many as 2.5 million Hong Kong citizens coming to the UK, I think when you look at the small print, it'll be a much more closely defined group, and actually not that many will want to come anyway. So that's one thing. The second thing more broadly is that we're seeing a change in the government's attitude to Chinese investment. These were changes that were in the pipeline, but they're being given a particular Chinese tilt, which is to say that foreign takeovers are going to be monitored much more closely than at present.
I think when it's come to China, there's no any good words about China. And China is really regarded, as an evil.
The Chinese ambassador to the UK has been very vocal in his response to what the UK has been saying. They're saying that any kind of change to citizenship law for Hong Kong citizens would represent foreign interference in China and lead to repercussions and consequences, which they've not yet spelled out. But the clear implication is that there might be a withdrawal of Chinese investment from the UK, and more worrying for the UK would be the imposition of trade barriers for British goods being sold into China. And if the UK ends up being on China's kind of blacklist of countries that with which they will not trade, that would be a huge disadvantage to the UK. And you've got to bear in mind that the UK doesn't have good relations with Russia either. The relations with America blow hot and cold. And as we know, we haven't yet settled our trade relationships with the European Union. And the danger is you end up at a time when the UK is in a totally new diplomatic place. The danger is that it isn't building alliances, it's losing friends, and it can't rely purely on an historical alliance such as the Commonwealth to survive. It needs to think very strategically about where its friendships are going to be and how far it wants to push this argument with China, and whether it can in any way ring fence the argument to be about Hong Kong but not about wider relations with China.
That was The Guardian's Patrick Wintour. After the break, I speak to Haroon Sadiq and Joseph Harker about why MPs from both sides of the political divide are struggling to find the right words or actions to address racism in the UK. We'll be back after this.
Hey, it's Leia Green here. I want to tell you about a new podcast we're launching, and we want to get you involved. It's called All By Ourselves, and right now we're collecting stories about relationships, life events, and our inner selves. Anything that's significant for you at the moment.
The curtain goes round the coffin while you listen to some bit of Mozart or whatever it is, and that feels very strange.
Oh, my brother, he suffers from schizophrenia. He's got this like really weird thing in his head where he thinks like I'm like a witch.
So if you have a story you want to share, big or small, funny or tragic, weird or wonderful, get in touch. Email us on all.by.ourselves@theguardian.com or visit gu.com/ABO.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Now, the last couple of weeks have forced many in the UK to look inward at the country's problem with racism. The very moment that the video of George Floyd being killed by a Minneapolis police officer made its way across the Atlantic saw the publication of an official report showing that black, Asian and minority ethnic people in this country were dying disproportionately of COVID-19 in comparison to white people. As protests followed around the country, politicians have seemed to struggle to walk that fine line of supporting the protesters' cause on the one hand, while at the same time condemning any act that either contravenes social distancing guidelines or entails the damage of public property, even when that public property is a statue of the notorious slave trader Edward Colston. Government ministers have used strong language to denounce the toppling of that Colston statue into the harbour in Bristol, stronger, some might say, than they were in condemning Colston's record, or even racism itself. But they aren't the only ones struggling with this. Labour MPs have been divided in their messaging. The London MP and former Shadow Minister Dawn Butler, for example, tweeted her disagreement with the leader of her party after Keir Starmer was reported to have said the protesters in Bristol were completely wrong, even as he acknowledged that the monument should never have been there in the first place. So why do politicians find it so difficult to talk about and tackle race and racism? On Monday, I spoke with The Guardian's Haroon Sadiq, who's been reporting on the impact of COVID-19 on the BAME community, and to Joseph Harker, The Guardian's deputy opinion editor. Let's start with you, Joseph. Why do you think they have been so clear, the government, in this position, condemning what happened in Bristol, even though they will know that for a very sizable chunk of British public opinion, that position will make those people pretty angry?
I think government has to believe in the rule of law. It, above all else, it's there. It's only there because of the rule of law. So in a way, I think it's understandable. Even Keir Starmer talked about it being against the law and a crime. And so I think that they just, regardless of the morals of the particular statue and the particular issue here, I think the idea of a government that says it's okay for a group of a crowd to start tearing down statues, could be buildings next, whatever, is a kind of knee-jerk response. Where I think they have gone maybe too insensitively is to talk about, even if you talk, this is a criminal act, I think they need to balance that more with a sense of, look, we know why it was done, we understand the motives behind it, and he was a bad man, and in a way, you know, his statue should have come down years ago, and we were sorry it got to this. But I think in a way they have to say the rule of law is crucial and must be upheld by all.
Can I push it even further and say that you have some sympathy for that position, that no matter how immoral and repugnant, actually, the subject of a sculpture might be, the right channel is democratic channels and sort of, you know, political decisions rather than what we saw in Bristol?
I think it has to be. I mean, I think they are, and they're politicians. If I was Prime Minister, I wouldn't want people tearing down monuments without it going through a democratic process. I think what effectively has happened here, though, is the democratic process has failed. And that despite all the protests of people in Bristol for years about the message it sends out about having a statue of a slaver in the centre of the city, the democratic process never actually allowed for that statue to be taken down, and was all the will of the people was always overcome by the will of money and the will of powerful people within the city of Bristol who wanted to keep the statue there.
Haroon, just on that, is it your sense that local councils around the country will now be looking with some alarm to know if they have any statues of racist or colonialist figures in their backyard that they better remove quickly unless they're going to be toppled and chucked in the river a la Bristol?
I hope so. I hope they will be removing them. I think they will come under threat because one of the arguments is that if you get rid of these statues, people won't know about the atrocities. But more importantly, I would put it to people like this. If I were to take my son for a walk and he were to see the statue and he were to ask, why is there a statue of that person? Am I really supposed to tell him that he was a slave owner, but it's there so we don't forget how bad people can be? Do you think he is really going to understand that? Do you think other children are really going to look at the statue and think, oh, right, that makes sense? Or are they going to think, are they going to be confused as to why someone who their parents are telling them is terrible has a statue honouring them?
Haroon, beyond just the business of statues and more broadly to these protests, the government has been saying, again, in a way, separating out the merits of the cause and instead trying to focus on the means by saying, look, no matter how just the cause of protesting, in the middle of a coronavirus pandemic, now is not the time to be out in huge crowds, mass gatherings on the streets without social distancing, etc. Do you have some sympathy for that position? To put it another way, how do you think the government would have responded if there wasn't a pandemic to contend with?
I imagine that it wouldn't have been that different. I mean, it's sensible to have concerns about the inability of people to practice social distancing at protests. But what you've got to consider is that Black and Asian minority ethnic people feel let down over COVID as well. And they feel that the government haven't protected them from COVID. And I think that's actually fueled the protests. So I would imagine protesters feel that it's quite rich of the government to kind of say, oh, don't protest because you're putting yourself at risk, when they don't really feel that the government's doing enough to protect them.
Haroon, we've been talking about the government's response to all this. It has been quite tricky for Labour too. What can you tell us about how they have dealt with this issue?
I mean, I think Sadiq Khan, for example, he raised more the public health issue of it in terms of people who are protesting, going home and inadvertently infecting a grandparent or something like that. He said that if it wasn't for the public health issue, he would be out there protesting with them. Labour obviously has a lot more Black MPs and from other minority ethnic groups than the government. And they have been very vocal in support of the protests. I think at the higher level, they are being more cautious. And I think this goes back to the thing that, to use the word racism or racist, it's become this thing that you can't say. And if you say it, if you accuse someone of it, you're suddenly the one who's under the microscope. And I think that's why you won't hear Matt Hancock and Boris Johnson say, oh, Britain is a racist country, but it's also what's stopping some of the people high up in the Labour leadership, because they fear that if they say Britain is a racist country, everyone will kind of say, well, and when I say everyone, I mean the white British population will say, hang on, I'm not racist. Why are they saying Britain's a racist country? But that's a misunderstanding of what this is about. It's about structural racism. It's about racism in the police, in the criminal justice system, in employment, housing, and education.
And so it's not just the coronavirus which makes it difficult as an issue. You're saying it's the actual politics around speaking about race and racism which makes it fraught for Labour politicians. Joseph, last week, our Guardian colleague Athol Hirsch wrote a piece in which he said that the British government should have, could have the humility to use this moment to acknowledge Britain's experiences. That's how she put it. And she went on to say the government had failed to do that. And she particularly picked out on this appointment of Kemi Badenoch, the Minister for Equalities and a black woman herself, to, in his words, get to the bottom of the problem. Back in 2017, she was quoted as saying, "We don't have all the horrible stuff that's happened in America here." So what do you think, Joseph, of this appointment of her, asking her to, quote, get to the bottom of this problem? Do you think it's, how is that going to go down with black British opinion particularly?
I don't think many black British people would know who Kemi Badenoch is to even have a view on her. But all I can say is you only have to look at, take a brief look at her history to say she doesn't believe in institutional racism, and she doesn't think that racism is has got anything to do with the scale of COVID deaths that many black and minority ethnic people are suffering at the moment. So we can't look to her to get an independent view on the crisis that's facing black, Asian and minority ethnic people right now. You know, this government does not have a very good record on race. For 10 years, they were deporting black British citizens under the hostile environment. We have a prime minister who describes Africans as pickaninnies, calls women niqab wearers bank robbers, and has failed to have a proper independent inquiry into Islamophobia within his own party, which, as everyone knows, is rife. So we can't really expect a lot from this government, and Kemi Badenoch is just another sign of that.
On this podcast, we talked in great depth a couple of weeks back about the Dominic Cummings scandal and whether or not the government could ride it out, even though at the time it was at fever pitch and it looked as if they couldn't. With this issue that's running so strongly now, what's your sense that will Boris Johnson be forced to make some kind of change this time? Or is this too, like the Cummings affair, although of course entirely different, something that he can just in the end let pass because, you know, the media and political caravan will move on?
I think there's demands for racial justice in this country. I think right now it's not that difficult a political storm for Boris Johnson to ride out. I think at the moment there's not any great... With Dominic Cummings, there was a specific call for one person to resign. And there was, despite the massive evidence and the massive public support for that, he wrote it out. In terms of the current Black Lives Matter protests, I think the demands are so vague right now. No one really has a sense of what people actually want. Is it to disband the police? Is it to reform the police? Is it just about the police? Is it about criminal justice more widely? It'd be very easy for Boris Johnson just to announce some vague, we'll look into it and I'll put a minister in to look into it, and then kick it into the long grass and ride it out like that without coming up with any specific proposals. I don't think it's that much of a political problem for this government. There will be things that could flare up if Boris Johnson, for example, says that Colston must rise and that he wants the statue of the slave owner put back on its plinth in the centre of Bristol. I think then that would be cause a massive storm, and there'd be a lot of reaction to that. But I think in a way he can just do nothing, say trite things like Britain's not a racist country, but there are pockets of racism, and in a way get away from it. Because as Haroon was saying, Labour under Keir Starmer doesn't really want to get on this territory either. They're not wanted to be called for radical reforms of the police or any other part of the state.
Why not? Why do you feel so strongly that it won't want to do that?
Because everything about Keir Starmer is very cautious. He will say, we must obey the law. He will say, I believe in justice. He will say, Black Lives Matter. But in terms of doing anything, making any radical proposals, Keir Starmer is the sort of the quiet civil servant type wanting to just play a cautious game. So I can't see Labour really doing an awful lot.
To what extent, Haroon, are all these issues now getting bundled up? And I'm thinking of all the long-established patterns of racism, some of them that both you and Joseph have mentioned, and this now very current phenomenon, which is the evidence showing that black and minority ethnic people are more likely to die from coronavirus and COVID than white people in Britain. Are the two issues now inseparable? I know, as I speak about this, that you've had of the coronavirus dimension of this very specific and personal loss as a result of this.
Yes, my father died towards the end of March with coronavirus symptoms. His situation was perhaps different in that he was 80 years old and he had Parkinson's, but these issues are all linked. If you speak to anyone, I think, who doesn't really have an agenda, you can't look at the disproportionate risk faced by Black, Asian and minority ethnic people from this awful virus without taking into account all these things. And if anything good comes out of this, it is that these structural inequalities have been highlighted. And that is why a number of campaigners are calling for a COVID racial equality audit. I mean, a lot of people have already known about these inequalities for years. They have existed for decades, but if this can shine a light on them and actually get some concerted action, then something good can possibly come out of this.
All right. Joseph Harker and Haroon Sadiq, thank you both very much. And you can read Haroon Sadiq's very moving obituary for his father, Mohammed Sadiq, in the Other Lives section of the Guardian website. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all from us this week. Now, Premiership Football will be making a long-awaited comeback next week, but with many in the football world wondering what they should be doing to tackle racism, our Football Weekly podcast have done a brilliant special that came out this morning. Just search for Football Weekly wherever you get your podcasts. A huge thanks to all of our guests, Heather Stewart, Patrick Wintour, Haroon Sadiq and Joseph Harker. The producer is Daniel Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please take care of yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.